History Daily is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians, these are the things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary, not available in all states or situations. Underneath my voice right now is the sound of business, the roar of jet engines on takeoff as heard from seat 17A. I'm flying back from Los Angeles, having attended a very successful podcast conference. These sorts of events are a whirlwind of meetings. And to fill you in on what the podcast industry is talking about, it's YouTube. Everyone knows that YouTube is an enormous player in the creator media landscape, and depending on which numbers you look at, a real and significant vehicle for podcast listenership. But not all podcasts work on YouTube. In fact, most don't. There's this pesky video component that many of us, myself included, have not figured out. But we're all working on it, thinking hard, performing experiments, making bets, all in the hopes that podcasters have a place in YouTube land. What we're not trying to do is plant rubber trees. And this left turn is brought to you by Henry Ford, who, after revolutionizing industry and becoming the wealthiest man on the planet, decided that he could impose his will on nature and be similarly successful. And not just that. He wanted to grow rubber trees in the Amazon, buying thousands of acres of virgin forest and trying to build his own slice of modernized, mechanized, industrialized, civilized America. This is going to prove harder for him than YouTube is for podcasters, for sure. And in fact, it will be a colossal failure that will cost him $500 million in modern money, and countless lives will be lost to disease, accident, and violence. And to tell this story, I bring you a podcast that's not on YouTube, My Own Business Movers. It's a tale of hubris, a stubborn effort that went on for 20 years, the folly of Fordlandia. I hope you enjoy. While you're listening, be sure to search for and follow Business Movers. We put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you. It's June 1876 in Belém, a port city in northern Brazil and the gateway to the Amazon River. British explorer Henry Wickham stands on the dock beside the SS Amazonas, a wooden-hulled cargo ship bound for England. Henry shifts nervously. Packed carefully into the cane baskets at his feet are 70,000 rubber seeds. Rubber is a valuable commodity, but it's only grown in the Amazon. Henry hopes to change that, though. He journeyed to the heart of the rainforest by pretending to be a botanist. Claiming that he wanted to study the region's plants, Henry then convinced locals to help him accumulate enough seeds to start a rubber plantation elsewhere. Now he just needs to get his precious cargo away from Brazil without being caught. Henry turns as the captain of the SS Amazonas stomps down the gangplank from the ship.
Captain Murray, is it?
George Murray, that's right. The men shake hands. Captain has a broad face that's scorched pink by the tropical sun. He picks at his burnt lips between sentences.
It's good to meet another honest Englishman out here. How can I be of assistance?
Well, I find myself in urgent need of safe passage back to England. I understand you're due to sail today,
within the hour, though we are fully laden.
The captain glances down toward the baskets by Henry's feet. Henry smiles nervously.
These are botanical specimens, quite delicate. And you have the relevant paperwork for these specimens? There lies the rub, Captain.
Oh, I see.
Well, I think we could squeeze you in, but without the right export papers, there's little I can do. Captain, regrettably, I've had little time in port. And the petty bureaucracy of these people, well, I'm sure I needn't tell you about it. Rest assured, my company back in England would be most grateful for any assistance you could offer.
The captain picks at his blistered mouth.
Oh, would they, indeed. How grateful.
Oh, very grateful.
See, I've done favors for people before, and they aren't always as grateful as you'd think.
Henry glances down the dock. A uniformed port officer is looking in their direction.
Well, perhaps we can discuss this more once we're underway. The captain follows his look towards the suspicious port officer and quietly signals to two of the ship's workers.
You two, take Mr. Wickham. Mr. Wickham's cargo on board and stow it far below.
The men nod and then grab the baskets. Henry winces as the rubber seeds are hoisted roughly onto their shoulders.
Oh, please do be careful with them. Thank you.
The men hurry up the gangplank with the baskets.
And thank you, Captain. Now, let me show you to a cabin. I'll find you once we're on the ocean, and we can discuss just how grateful your company needs to be.
Certainly, Captain.
Henry follows the other men up the gangplank and onto the ship.
You have me in a bind, though. I suppose if I'm not grateful enough, you could tip the seeds over the side.
The captain laughs and claps him on the shoulder.
No, no, Mr. Wickham. If you're not grateful enough, I'll tip you over the side.
Henry Wickham's illicit cargo was never searched or seized on the trip back to England. Out of the 70,000 rubber seeds Henry collected, only 4,000 proved viable. But that was enough to begin a successful plantation in Sri Lanka, the first place where rubber was grown outside of the Amazon. Henry's actions this day would ultimately launch a new global rubber industry, one that would decimate the Brazilian market. But decades later, that same theft would lead to a very different man venturing into the Amazon in search of the riches of the rainforest. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. Henry Ford founded the Ford Motor Company in 1903. 5 years later, the introduction of the hugely popular Model T automobile helped make Henry the richest man in the world. As the father of assembly line mass production, Henry streamlined the craft of making motor cars and changed the face of not just America, but the planet. There wasn't an inch of his factory's operation or performance that Henry didn't concern himself with. As the years went by, he took a special interest in rubber. Rubber wasn't just crucial for the gaskets, valves, hoses, and tires that went into the Ford motors. It was also needed for the machines used to assemble the cars. By the 1920s, rubber was as important a commodity to Henry Ford as oil or steel. At the time, synthetic rubber did exist, but it had not been commercialized successfully. It wasn't yet produced on a scale or at a price that could compete with the natural product. So car manufacturers like Henry were still dependent on vast rubber plantations where workers stripped thin layers of bark from trees to stimulate the production of a sticky, milky white fluid called latex. This was harvested and refined to form rubber. Brazil was the native home to the rubber tree and had once dominated the trade in latex. But thanks to the efforts of explorer Henry Wickham, the British were able to start new and more efficient rubber plantations in Southeast Asia. These were soon producing more rubber than all of South America combined, and by the 1920s, the British had a near monopoly on the global rubber market. This meant they could charge men like Henry Ford whatever they wanted for their product. This situation was unacceptable to Henry. He was the richest man in the world and expected that wealth to enable him to bend reality to his liking. But rubber remained beyond his grasp until Henry got an idea. One he thought would enable him to fight back against the British monopoly and finally seize complete control over everything going in and out of his factories. This is the first episode in our four-part series on Fordlandia, A Man and His Machine. It's July 1925 in Dearborn, Michigan, nearly a half century after Henry Wickham smuggled his cargo of rubber seeds out of the Amazon. In the opulent dining room of a grand mansion, Henry Ford lays his knife and fork down on his plate. The slender, gray-haired 61-year-old takes a sip of soy milk and watches as his dinner companion, Harvey Firestone, knock back yet another glass of whiskey. As the owners of the Ford Motor Company and the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, the two men are giants of their industry. They know each other well, too, and have enjoyed many fruitful collaborations over the years. Henry motions for his staff to refill Harvey's glass.
He himself abstains from alcohol, but he's happy for his guest to drink.
Why, thank you, Henry. Much obliged. Now, where was I? You were talking about rubber, Harvey, as almost always. Oh, yeah, those damn Brits. They're no better than gangsters, I tell you. It's a cartel. You know what the price per pound of rubber is now? 19 cents. Well, of course you'd know, Henry. You always know. Yes, yeah, that's right, 19 cents. It'll be over a dollar by the year's end, you mark my words. It's never been over 25 cents, Harvey, and you know it. It will go that high, though. You just watch. That is, if we don't do something about it. Oh, and you have a plan? We have got big plans. At the next meeting of the automobile industry leaders, you need to join us. Well, I might. Who is this us? Well, there's me, obviously, and General Motors Razkov and DuPont. If we stick together, we'll have more bargaining power than the Brits can cope with. You're beginning to sound like a union man. Well, I know you feel the same way, and I know you want to do something about it. You'll help us, won't you? I'm not interested in a collective union, whether by my workers or anyone else. You can keep your leaders' club. Oh, come on, Henry. How long have we been friends? 30 years? 31. Well, in all that time, I've never seen you run away from a fight. Oh, I'm not running away. So you have a plan of your own, then? Henry says nothing, and Harvey laughs. Well, what could it be? Harvey looks around the room, and then his eyes light up. Oh, you son of a gun. I know what you're up to. You're Henry Ford. Of course you have a plan. I don't know what you're talking about, Harvey. You're going to grow your own rubber, aren't you? Cut off the cartel at the source. Oh, Harvey, I think you've had enough to drink for one evening. Harvey laughs at this idea. No, that's it, isn't it? Henry Ford, the plantation man. Well, I'll tell you, I'll drink to that. If anyone can take on the British Empire alone, it's you.
Until this very moment, Henry Ford had not been planning to start a rubber plantation. But despite Harvey Firestone's drunkenness, Henry realized that his friend might be onto something. Growing his own rubber would allow Henry to take control of a commodity that was essential for both his cars and his factories. So shortly after Harvey left, Henry called in his personal secretary and gave his most trusted assistant a new task: find the best place in the world to build a rubber plantation. Henry Ford was no stranger to grandiose projects. A few years before he set his sights on building a plantation and breaking the global British domination of the trade in rubber, Henry had ideas for an equally ambitious proposal. In the summer of 1921, Henry put forward plans to buy a government-owned stretch of the Tennessee River in Alabama. This 70-mile tract of land was known as Muscle Shoals. And in collaboration with his friend and inventor, Thomas Edison, Henry hoped to build a power plant there, the likes of which the world has never seen, a huge hydroelectric dam surrounded by a new city, all nestled in the heart of nature. The scheme seemed an unlikely one for Harvey to invest in. For decades, the farmers near Muscle Shoals had been living in poverty. The isolated region was plagued by floods and stricken by crop disease. It was a place where residents could only dream of earning something like Henry Ford's $5 day, an initiative started in Henry's Detroit car factories, which offered a respectable day's wage for a respectable day's work. But Henry wasn't the first to see the potential of Muscle Shoals, though. During World War I, the U.S. government had begun construction on its own hydroelectric dam at the site. The plan was for the dam to power two nearby factories producing nitrate, a much-needed component in the manufacture of ammunition. But when World War I came to an end, the demand for huge quantities of nitrate fell away, as did interest in the Muscle Shoals project. By then, the U.S. government had already invested the modern equivalent of over $800 million, though. It was eager to recoup at least some of the investment, and Henry Ford was more than happy to step in and pay for the lease of the site. The cost was $90 million in today's money, but a drop in the bucket for a man as wealthy as Henry. Word soon got out that Henry Ford was taking over and completing the dam in Muscle Shoals. Some started calling the project the Detroit of the South, comparing it to the industrial hub that had grown up around Henry's businesses in Michigan. But for Henry, Muscle Shoals represented much more. It was a near blank sheet of paper on which he could build whatever he wanted, and Henry had grand plans. Henry's metropolis on the Tennessee River would be unlike anything people would recognize as a city. It would combine two of his greatest loves, farming and industry. It wouldn't be a built-up area of urban living, but a sprawling stretch of rural life. And the hydroelectric power plant at its heart would provide cheap electricity for all. And it was the dam that was the most important part of the project to Henry. It was a step toward his dream of reshaping the entire American economy. He believed that by controlling the supply of power, he could ultimately break the influence of Wall Street banks, which he despised. And as more people learned about Henry's proposal, excitement bordering on hysteria spread throughout the region. The news sparked a land grab in Alabama. Farms that had been vacant since the abolition of slavery were now changing hands at record prices. The New York Times called the swift movement of people towards Alabama a new gold rush. Everyone seemed convinced that the Muscle Shoals project would transform the prospects of the entire state, providing an economic lift to all the cities and towns close by. Louisville, Birmingham, Jacksonville, and many more would receive a boost from Henry's new city and its power plant. People in Alabama started to see Henry as a Moses-like figure, one who would tame the troublesome waters and lead them to the promised land. And everything was going the way Henry had hoped, until trouble brewed in Washington, D.C. Henry needed congressional approval for the Muscle Shoals project. He was lobbying hard and confident he would win the vote. Or at least he was, until the intervention of a Republican senator from Nebraska named George Norris. Despite both being teetotaling isolationists, George and Henry had little common ground politically, and George had no qualms about taking on the mighty Henry Ford. Senator George Norris was spooked by reports about land in Alabama being sold at inflated prices. George then began to investigate Henry's bid in greater depth. It didn't take him long to see the huge potential for profit at Muscle Shoals. But he came to the conclusion that if anyone was going to reap the benefits of the dam project, it should be the federal government, not the shareholders of a private business like the Ford Motor Company. So George did all he could to counter Henry's proposal. He raised questions many hadn't asked about what kind of ownership Henry would have over the natural resources around Muscle Shoals. He argued that Henry was effectively buying a piece of America that rightly belonged to all Americans, not something that should be put up for sale to the highest bidder. George's pointed questions poked more and more holes in Henry's project, and others in Congress soon began to express doubts of their own. The wheels were coming off the Muscle Shoals project. And as uncertainty over the future of the dam grew, there was outrage in Alabama. For many locals, Henry and his company represented the future, an escape from the poverty they'd experienced all their lives. For those who had already heavily invested in the area, they felt tricked by the possibility of the project's collapse. Such was the anger of some that Senator Norris soon had to be accompanied by an armed bodyguard at all times. Henry didn't take the opposition of the senator lightly either. He owned several newspapers and made sure that his publications ran story after unfavorable story about George. But the smear campaign didn't work. Despite passing the House of Representatives, Henry's proposal was voted down by George Norris and his colleagues in the Senate. The Muscle Shoals project died right there. Henry Ford never found out if he could bring his vision to Alabama, never discovered if he could tame the mighty Tennessee River and turn its waters into power for the surrounding communities. In Henry's mind, his plans have been blocked by bitter politicians with no vision of their own. And he became determined that the next time opportunity knocked for a grand, transformative project like Muscle Shoals, he would look outside of the United States of America. That opportunity presented itself only just a few years later in 1925. Following the suggestion of his friend Harvey Firestone, Henry decided to enter a new industry. He ordered his personal secretary to investigate the best location for a rubber plantation. And it wasn't long before Henry's man came back with an answer. There was only one place Henry should consider, the place where rubber originated. Henry Ford was going to build his own rubber plantation, and he would do it in the heart of the Amazon. History Daily is sponsored by Quince. What's the difference between a closet and a wardrobe? Well, a closet is a small space full of clothes. A wardrobe is a statement to the world that you have style and taste. That's where Quince shines. Premium fabrics, considered design, and everyday essentials that feel effortless to wear and dependable, even as the seasons change. Like lightweight sweaters or short-sleeve polos in real Mongolian cashmere, bottoms and shorts in European linen, and 100% long staple Pima cotton tees. These are attractive, versatile pieces built to hold up to regular wear and still look good. Like the pieces we outfitted our daughter with, a new hoodie,
a bracelet, and some wide-leg fleece pants that were the hit of winter. Right now, go to quince.com/historydaily for free shipping and 365-day returns. That's a full year to build your wardrobe and love it, and you will. Now available in Canada, too. So don't keep settling for clothes that don't last. Go to quince.com/historydaily for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/historydaily. History Daily is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians, these are the things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary, not available in all states or situations. It's late summer 1926 in Dearborn, Michigan, 2 years after the collapse of Henry Ford's Muscle Shoals project. At the world-famous Ford Motor Company factory, Henry is in the process of winding up a personal tour for a special guest. The VIP is a 35-year-old Brazilian businessman named Jorge Dumont Villares. Jorge has come to Dearborn to discuss the proposed rubber plantation in the Brazilian rainforest. But Henry can't help feeling skeptical about his visitor. Distinguishing con men from genuine businessmen has always been difficult for Henry. Everyone wants a piece of him and his wealth, and Henry must constantly be on guard. Stepping away from the factory floor, Henry leads Jorge into his office.
I'm ever so grateful for the tour, Mr. Ford. What you have achieved here is very impressive.
It's kind of you to say, Mr. Villares. Please, take a seat.
Well, Mr. Ford, I'll cut to the chase. Brazil wants you. Brazil wants Ford. And that's kind of you to say, too. But what exactly does Brazil want me for?
You are being coy. I know you have met with a number of politicians from my country about starting a rubber plant. What I'm here to tell you is you do not need a politician. You need a man like yourself, a businessman.
Henry leans back in his chair.
And let me guess, you would be that businessman.
Undeterred by Henry's skepticism, Jorge carries on with his pitch.
May I show you something, Mr. Ford?
By all means.
From his bag, Jorge pulls out a map and unrolls it on the desk in front of Henry.
This is a chart of the area we want for you, the Tapajós Valley. 2.5 million acres of prime Brazilian real estate, and it could be yours. The most fertile and healthy region in the tropical world. Our government already has plans to build roads hundreds of miles long for all your distribution needs. And as well as the rubber, you could mine gold, oil, diamonds, and the power of the Amazon itself could be yours with a dam, like the one they wouldn't let you build in Alabama.
I see you've done your research, Mr. Villares.
I have, but I saved the best for last, sir.
Jorge leans forward and taps the map.
Here, right in the center, this will be a space cleared for two new towns. Fordville, named after yourself, and Edselville for your son. Brazil is open for business, Mr. Ford, and we want you to be our number one partner. Your father is a businessman as well, Mr. Villares?
My family has been growing and exporting coffee in Brazil for many years, yes. That's how we made our fortune.
That's how your father made his fortune, you mean?
True enough. But I will make mine in rubber with you.
It's a good pitch, Mr. Villares, and thank you for sharing it with me. I will give it careful consideration.
Mr. Ford, sir, this opportunity will not be around forever. There is a chance that if we delay, the land may be sold. To the Japanese, perhaps, or the Germans, even to the British.
Don't overplay your hand. I wouldn't dream of it. I only mean to warn you. I've said I'll give your proposal some thought. And that's more than most get out of this office. My people will be in touch.
Jorge knows that this meeting is over. He rises to his feet.
Well, thank you, Mr. Ford, for meeting with me and for showing me your magnificent factory. I hope that with or without you, I can help bring some of what you have done to my country. I look forward to speaking again.
No one had ever made Henry Ford a business proposal like this one. Millions of acres of rainforest, two towns with the space for hundreds of thousands of workers. The whole venture was unprecedented in scale. But the more Henry thought about Jorge Villares' proposal, the more intrigued he became. The cost would certainly be enormous. But if it worked, Henry knew that the rewards could be even greater.
By 1926, Henry Ford had given up the title of president of the Ford Motor Company. He had handed the role to his 33-year-old son, Edsel Ford. But the passing of the baton to the next generation was purely symbolic. Every major decision about the future of the company Henry founded was still made by the man himself, and that included everything to do with the proposed rubber plantation in Brazil. But before he could make his idea public, Henry knew he needed a detailed report on every inch of the land he was looking to buy in the Amazon. Most importantly, Henry had to know if the region itself could provide the rubber he wanted at the scale he needed. So he commissioned a botanist to travel to the Amazon and survey the proposed site. Carl LaRue's report was compiled and dated April 19, 1927. It was an in-depth look at whether or not the Brazilian rainforest was a suitable location for Henry's rubber plantation. The report's answer was an enthusiastic yes. LaRue suggested that the site proposed by Jorge Villares in the Tapajos Valley was perfectly positioned to grow rubber. The land's drainage was excellent, and the soil was rich enough to sustain both the quantity and quality of trees Henry would need to turn a profit. LaRue confidently announced that properly cared for, trees on the site could produce up to a gallon of rubber every day. That would take a while, though. A rubber tree had to mature for 5 years before it was ready for its latex to be tapped. Henry could be waiting a long time to see results. But LaRue had a solution. He suggested that mining gold and diamonds, as well as felling timber, could help the project turn a profit while Henry waited for the rubber trees to grow. LaRue then gave a side-by-side comparison between the proposed site in Brazil and another possibility in Sumatra, Indonesia. The Asian candidate was not far from where other rubber plantations were already set up and yielding impressive results. LaRue listed the merits of each site in categories like growth potential, rubber yield, land costs, and transportation links. According to LaRue, the South American location beat out the Asian in nearly every one. But that glowing conclusion wasn't the end of the report. LaRue didn't limit himself to merely opinions on the climate and geography of the proposed site or its suitability for growing rubber. He also passed judgment on the people living in the region as well. This section of the report was far more negative than the first, but it was equally appealing to Henry Ford for precisely that reason. LaRue described the people living along the Tapajos Valley as destitute. He used words like poor and penniless, thin, yellow, and weak. He explained how local infants would often die at a young age, and even if they lived longer, they didn't enjoy anything approaching a fulfilling existence. LaRue lamented that the children had no school, no play, and no hope of life. In Detroit, Henry Ford had made a name for himself as a philanthropist. One of Henry's key initiatives was improving healthcare. He had established a state-of-the-art hospital which charged everyone in the community the same for medical treatment. It was these charitable instincts which LaRue prodded with his tales of death and disease in the Amazon. LaRue wrote account after account detailing the unfairness of life in the valley. In one example, LaRue recalled how his team had tried to give the inexpensive antimalarial drug quinine to a sick man, but the worker's boss had snatched it away, calling such kindness a waste, leaving the man to his fate. That seemed typical of how people were treated in the region. LaRue presented the local traders as villains who took advantage of their workers whenever they could, who didn't care whether their employees lived or died no matter how hard they worked. Henry Ford, LaRue insinuated, would never treat people in such a way. In all, LaRue painted a picture of the ideal project for Henry Ford. Henry could buy all the land he wanted at a bargain price. He could mold it in any way he saw fit. He would have all he needed for the rubber trees he wanted to grow, and there would be a deeper social calling behind the project as well. Henry Ford and Henry Ford alone could save the people of the Tapajos Valley. He could help them fight disease. He could give their children all the things they lacked, good health, a good education, and some hope for the future. So as Henry read the report, it became increasingly unthinkable for him not to proceed. By the time he reached the end, he had decided. The man who had made such a mark on America was going to do the same for Brazil. Some at the Ford Motor Company, however, viewed the growing momentum behind the plantation project with alarm. If anything, they thought LaRue's report was too perfect. It was so positive that some in the company quietly wondered if the botanist had been bribed by Brazilian backers. But they didn't dare express those doubts to the boss. The market was skeptical of new rubber initiatives, too. In the summer of 1927, just as LaRue's report made the case for Henry sinking millions of dollars into the Brazilian rainforest, the price of rubber suddenly fell. New plantations had opened in Asia. These were run by the Dutch and weren't part of the British monopoly. So as fresh supplies of rubber entered the market, the cost tumbled. This was a relief to those in Dearborn who doubted the wisdom of the Ford Motor Company investing in Brazil. The business reasons for setting up the plantation in the Amazon were fading away. But by then, it was too late. LaRue's report may or may not have been a sham, but it was effective. Henry had already committed to the project. The report had convinced him that building the plantation was not only the right business decision, it was also a moral mission. But Henry was no longer the president of the Ford Motor Company. For the project to officially move forward, it would have to be approved by the firm's chief, Henry's only child, Edsel. So Henry would soon call a meeting with his son to tell him exactly how he should proceed. History Daily is sponsored by Quince. What's the difference between a closet and a wardrobe? Well, a closet is a small space full of clothes. A wardrobe is a statement to the world that you have style and taste. That's where Quince shines. Premium fabrics, considered design, and everyday essentials that feel effortless to wear and dependable, even as the seasons change. Like lightweight sweaters or short-sleeve polos in real Mongolian cashmere, bottoms and shorts in European linen, and 100% long staple Pima cotton tees. These are attractive, versatile pieces built to hold up to regular wear and still look good. Like the pieces we outfitted our daughter with, a new hoodie, a bracelet, and some wide-leg fleece pants that were the hit of winter. Right now, go to quince.com/historydaily for free shipping and 365-day returns. That's a full year to build your wardrobe and love it, and you will. Now available in Canada, too. So don't keep settling for clothes that don't last. Go to quince.com/historydaily for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/historydaily. History Daily is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians, these are the things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary, not available in all states or situations. It's June 1927 at a test circuit in Dearborn, Michigan, 2 months after Henry Ford received the report on his proposed Brazilian rubber plantation. Henry and his 33-year-old son, Edsel, watch as drivers test the new Model A on a closed track. Edsel helped shepherd this car through development, and he's proud of what his team has created. Yet he's still anxious to hear what his father might think of it. Edsel has been president of the Ford Motor Company for nearly a decade, but the title is little more than a pretense. The company's founder and Edsel's dad is still the one who makes all the key decisions. Edsel lives firmly in Henry's shadow and is desperate for his father's approval as the Model A comes to a stop in front of them. We're really pleased with this one. It's got an updated inline four-cylinder engine, a three-speed sliding mesh, and you can now see the fuel level from the driver's seat. It'll be available as a coupe, a cabriolet, a sedan. What do you think about the rubber plantation idea? I was trying to tell you about the Model A. Henry shoots his son a look. It's one Edsel has seen a million times before, and it still puts Edsel in his place. Edsel motions to the driver in front of them to lap the course once more. Henry reiterates his question. So, what do you think? Opening a plantation in South America? Well, I'm not so sure about it, to be honest, sir. The cost of rubber is at an all-time low. And as far as I understand it, the indications are it's going to drop even further. So you think we should just keep paying others for what we can make ourselves? I'm saying, from a business point of view. A business point of view? Oh, do please enlighten me, Edsel, about business. Tell me all the business behind the rubber in our tires and fuel lines and machines that build our cars. Sir, the setup costs alone would be hundreds of millions of dollars. Oh, so we're too broke for it. Is that what you're saying? I'll have to speak to those accountants you seem to love so much. Find out where all our money has gone. Maybe you spent it on this new car of yours. We're not broke, sir. We've just had one of our best years.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because maybe an investment for the future is a good idea right now. But what do we know about growing rubber?
Henry places a hand on his son's shoulder.
We know that it's the right move for the Ford Motor Company.
Edsel says nothing. He knows the decision has already been made.
And his father smiles.
So you agree.
I'll get the paperwork drawn up.
Ah, good boy. You've made the right choice.
Edsel looks at his feet as the car he's devoted the last 2 years of his life to stops in front of them once again.
But what about the Model A, sir? What do you think of it?
Still needs some work.
Henry slaps his son on the back and turns to leave.
But you're the man in charge, Edsel. I'm just here for you to keep me busy.
As was usually the case, Henry Ford got his way again. Edsel soon dispatched a company man to the Amazon to negotiate the purchase of the land and begin construction work on the plantation. Willis Reeves Blakely would be the first in a long line of managers for Henry's new ventures. In many ways, though, he would prove to be the worst. Willis Reeves Blakely was a thuggish man who wasn't known for his people skills. Even on the journey south to Brazil, Willis found a way to upset those around him. When the 35-year-old saw the sleeping quarters he and his wife had been allocated for the voyage, he declared them unsuitable for a man of his status. He whined and moaned and threatened to call off the entire trip until he was given the plush stateroom belonging to one of the ship's officers. But things got even worse when Willis reached his destination. The Brazilian port of Belém was full of bars, casinos, and brothels, and Willis was soon a regular customer. Despite the presence of his wife on the trip, Willis earned a reputation in the city that the upstanding Henry Ford would have found horrifying. But Henry heard nothing about his employee's debauchery. He was only interested in the progress of the plantation. And in terms of the contract for the land, Willis came through. His typically bullish negotiating techniques enabled Ford to secure over 2.5 million acres of the Amazon rainforest at a cost of just $125,000. In modern money, that's less than a dollar an acre. And with the contract signed, Willis headed straight for the site. It was situated on the east bank of the Tapajós River, over 100 miles from the nearest major town. Recruiting a team of 25 locals with little forethought or planning, Willis immediately set to work. The first job was to clear an area of forest for housing and production buildings that would be needed for the plantation. But it was the rainy season, and the dense forest was a cauldron of wet heat. Willis didn't let that stop him. He ordered his men to start felling trees at once, but there was nowhere to dispose of the wood, and soon severed trunks and branches were heaped up in unstable piles all over the site. Willis tried to burn them, but the wood was too damp. He was told that he'd have to wait until the rains passed and the wood could dry out a little, but Willis was not a patient man. Wanting to clear the land as quickly as possible, he ordered the workers to douse the sodden trees in kerosene. Soon the site was shrouded in a thick cloud of black smoke. No one could breathe, let alone work, and the clearance efforts ground to a halt. Back in America, Henry Ford became worried. 2 months into the project, the glowing early reports had been replaced by silence. And when Willis finally did get in touch with Dearborn, it was to ask for a raise. Disturbed, Henry sent men to investigate. When they reported back, Henry was shocked. No work had been done on the site in 4 weeks. Food was rotting. Sanitation conditions were appalling. And Willis's incompetence had by now turned to criminality. He had started to steal pay from his workers, and like the corrupt bosses depicted in the LaRue report, Willis had even denied his men the quinine and other essential medications needed to stave off fever in the rainforest. Disgusted, Henry called Willis back to America and promptly fired him. But the misadventures of Willis Blakely didn't shake Henry's confidence in the wider project. He remained convinced that the plantation would be a success, dreaming of one day walking the streets of Fordville, the town named after the man that tamed the mighty Amazon rainforest. But the mighty Amazon rainforest would have other ideas. Even the name Fordville wouldn't last long. Henry might have wanted to impose his own values, his own ideas on Brazil, but already it seemed that the rainforest was taking his dream and twisting it. Fordville would never catch on as the name of Henry's project. Instead, it would be a local name that would stick. Henry Ford's plantation city would not be Fordville, but Fordlandia. From Wondery, this is episode 1 of Henry Ford's Paradise Lost for Business Movers. On the next episode, a new manager arrives in Fordlandia as the construction team faces new hazards, including wild animals, deadly diseases, and worker riots. If you'd like to learn more about Fordlandia, we recommend Fordlandia, The Rise and Fall of Henry Ford's Forgotten Jungle City by Greg Grandin, The Thief at the End of the World, Rubber, Power, and the Seeds of Empire by Joe Jackson, and Henry Ford by Vincent Curcio. A quick note about our dramatizations. In most cases, we can't know everything that happened, but all our reenactments are based on historical research. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Mohammed Shazi. Sound design by Molly Bond. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Owen Paul Nichols. Executive producers are William Simpson for Airship and Aaron O'Flaherty, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Marsha Louie for Wondery.